This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So this visit is very important because it will help not only to show Africa that the U.S. is still concerned about Africa, it will also help elevate Kenya's diplomatic role and Kenya's importance in global and continental politics.
That's Dr. Edgar Gitua, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, on Kenya's President William Ruto's visit to the U.S. Details coming up. Also, South Africa's economic freedom fighters aim to cut the majority of the ruling African National Congress, held power for 30 years. And Chadian Prime Minister Success Mazara today submitted his resignation. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. 6 years ago, the United States and Kenya elevated their ties to a strategic partnership. They also established a strategic dialogue that gave priority to economic prosperity, trade, investment, democracy, governance, regional issues, public health, among other things. As President William Ruto embarks on his historic trip to the United States this week, Dr. Edgar Gitua, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, tells me the visit is poised to be a turning point for Kenya and is aimed at strengthening ties between the two nations.
Dr. President William Samoei Ruto's historic visit to the United States, state visit to be exact, is of significance because, number one, it underscores Kenya and the U.S. relationship on the African continent. It also underscores the importance Kenya has in the eyes of the United States of America as an ally on the African continent. Kenya is a big brother taking care of security issues, trying to mediate and broker peace in the Eastern DRC, in the conflicts in Ethiopia, in South Sudan. So Kenya has a very important place in the heart and in the eyes of the United States of America as an ally on the African continent. So this visit is very important because it will help not only to show Africa that the U.S. is still concerned about Africa, it will also help elevate Kenya's diplomatic role and Kenya's importance in global and continental politics.
And Doctor, multinational companies have put their eyes on Kenya. Could you elaborate on what Kenya can offer?
You're very right. Definitely during this historic visit, trade is going to be one of the biggest focuses of the president. He has said it verbally that he wants to make Kenya the business and investment destination on the eastern coast of Africa. So he's definitely going to the U.S. with an aim of attracting big multinational companies to come and invest. Because when they invest in the country, we're talking about job creation and job employment for very, very many Africans and especially Kenyans. When he goes there and gets these big companies to also come and invest in the country, we are getting what we call technology transfer. So there are so many benefits. He's also going there to also attract U.S. investment in infrastructure development. We're talking about roads, telecoms, software development. So there will be all these opportunities for him to talk to various business caucuses in the United States of America. So there will be opportunities for all that. I see that being on the agenda, and it will play a big role. One of the biggest things he's going to be talking about.
And Doctor, during the discussions, I presume multilateral issues will feature, including development bank reforms and reforms at the UN Security Council. And then this Haiti mission, which is being led by Kenya and whose deployment is set to take place in a matter of days.
Definitely. In the peace and security agenda, that will definitely come up. He has gone with his national security advisor, a very experienced diplomat, a security expert called Dr. Monica Juma. So the moment we saw her on his entourage, we knew peace and security is going to be one of the things he will discuss. Remember, the Haiti mission, of which Kenya volunteered to send 1,000 police officers, It is the U.S. that is backing the mission. It is the U.S. that is bankrolling this mission. So definitely, President Joe Biden will want to get a report on the force readiness posture of the country. How far are we in training our police officers to take up the mission? President Ruto will also want to seek assurances that the finances and logistics are coming in. And it was just yesterday I was reading, and some contractors from Pentagon are already in Haiti creating the military barracks or the quarters where the Kenyan soldiers are going to be stationed, Kenyan police officers are going to be stationed. So they will definitely exchange information about how soon the deployment can take place. Already 10 police officers with a commanding officer are already in Haiti as we speak right now. A contingent of 200 soldiers, police officers are going to be sent within the next 1 week or so. So I'm sure they will update each other on the status of the finances, the logistics, and how soon the soldiers can be deployed. So those are going to feature strongly in the peace and security talks. On the African continent, the president is going to brief President Joe Biden on the security issue in the Eastern DRC, on the Sudan conflict, in the South Sudan mediation talks, which are already being held and were launched from Nairobi. So at least he'll be able to tell the U.S. and especially President Joe Biden just what role Kenya is playing in fostering peace and security on the continent and in the eastern part of East Africa.
That was Dr. Edgar Gituwa, international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University, Nairobi, speaking to me from Nairobi. The White House will roll out the red carpet for the first African leader to be hosted for a state visit since 2008 tomorrow. Later in the evening, Kenyan President William Ruto will be a guest of honor at a state dinner. Reporter Ruben Chama spoke with students from the University of Nairobi's Department of Diplomacy and International Studies to hear their thoughts about the Ruto trip. Sabdioro Roba hopes Ruto comes home with solutions to some of the country's problems.
And I think depending on the agenda of the visit, concerning the problems that Kenya is facing, we all know about the flood and stuff. I expect the president to come back with applicable solutions that will actually work.
Andrew Okonda hopes the trip helps Ruto fulfill pledges his government has made.
My expectations about the state visit is actually to improve relations between the U.S. and Kenya and actually bring more opportunities for Kenyans. And I want to see actual implementation of whatever he's going to do, whatever his goals are and his aims are during the visit. I hope they'll be able to implement, because there's been a lot of promises and these promises kills a lot of people's hope.
Tamera Ogidi hopes the visit will strengthen trade and investment with the U.S.
In regards to Ruto's state visit to the U.S., I think Kenya would hope to strengthen the bilateral ties between the two states. We would want to see a governmental intervention to strengthen industrial areas like the fabric, because we already saw that Kenya is one of the leading exporters to the U.S. in terms of textiles and fabrics. Ask where we would have the U.S. investors invest in Kenya, because that would boost the economy.
Albert Mutomi says creating jobs is among the most important issues he wants to see addressed.
Expectations from the state visit to U.S. from Dr. William Samoei Ruto. First of all, our economic status is not good. He has of late increased tax rates and a lot of things. He made a lot of promises during the campaign period. So my expectation from his state visit is on how to improve economic status for youths, maybe provide opportunities for employment here, let's say technology, on how maybe we can do online business to improve our standards of living, since we have high rate of unemployment here in Kenya.
For more on President Ruto's state visit to Washington, check out voaafrica.com and all your favorite VOA programs. In South Africa's election next Wednesday, the leftist economic freedom fighters EFF group is expected to consolidate its position as the country's third largest political party. Polls indicate the ruling African National Congress is expected to lose the majority it held for 30 years, potentially activating a partnership with the EFF. Darren Taylor reports.
Economic Freedom Fighters leader Julius Malema's main promise is government control of all private land and property to redistribute to poor black citizens. Speaking to journalists in Johannesburg recently, the outspoken 43-year-old said he'd only confiscate what he called unproductive land from white people, and white farmers in particular.
Their farming continues, is going to be protected, that is food security, but they are not the owners of the land. We are just going to wake up in the morning and remove people's graves and evict workers and violate workers as they wish. And there are a lot of farms. You just have a huge farm called a game farm. There's no game in it, not even as smallest impala. And next to it, there are communities that are living in a congested environment. Why shouldn't we expropriate that land? Because we can benefit as many people as we want.
But Malema's acknowledged Euro worship of deceased Zimbabwean leader Robert Mugabe has people worried. Mugabe is blamed for Zimbabwe's economic collapse, partly by seizing white-owned farms. Malema also promises big increases in minimum wages and social grants, and free electricity, water, education, and healthcare for 20 million citizens living in extreme poverty. The former African National Congress youth leader, who often wears a red beret and red overalls, says he'll get the money for all this from the people he thinks own South Africa, local and foreign white capitalists. Malema and the EFF want to nationalize businesses and property, including banks and mineral resources.
Nationalization means that there will be state-owned banks, there will be state-owned mines. Let's take a mine of Anglo-American. Anglo-American no longer mines. In South Africa, they get mining rights and all of that and then give to private companies to come and mine on their behalf. Why? It's a profitable mine. Why would a state give away such an asset? It must give itself that asset.
Malema's mantra is give the country's riches to the poor. But the self-declared communist forever never mentions that he's very wealthy himself, owning mansions and luxury vehicles. He's been investigated by South Africa's parliament, law enforcement and news media for alleged corruption, including funding his lavish lifestyle with funds from a trust supposed to benefit poor people. Malema has denied the allegations and he's never been convicted of financial crimes. Despite the EFF's populism, surveys suggest the party won't better previous election performances next week, and at best will win 11% of the vote. Prince Mashele of the Center for Politics and Research in Johannesburg says this is because the EFF's a personality cult, not a political party.
Julius Malema, as the leader of the party, does have appeal. The entire party hangs on his charisma. There is no party beyond Julius Malema. Take local government elections. The EFF does not win wards. Why? Because the so-called ground forces, the leaders of the EFF, the councillors, are not trusted by communities. So communities don't vote for those characters. The EFF only performs well when it comes to proportional representation. Why? Because that's when it is possible to benefit from the image of the leader.
Yet, say political analysts, there is a route to increased power for the EFF. If the ANC vote falls to around 40%, as some polls forecast, the ruling party will need the EFF's votes to stay in government. Malema says he's willing to form a coalition, but only if the ANC implements his party's policies. Critics say if that happens, investors might flee South Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Malawi's youngest member of parliament, Fines Magonjwa, has taken the lead in the fight against barriers that exclude young people from entering politics. The 24-year-old lawmaker in Malawi's eastern region district of Machinga. She says young people face strong resistance when running for elections despite the country's predominantly young people. Chimwemwi Padata reports from Lilongwe, Malawi.
Fines Magonjwa became Malawi's youngest lawmaker after securing a parliamentary seat in the 2019 elections. She is 28 years old now and has a message for young political aspirants.
It's time for us to fight for those positions. We can make it to those positions. Whether you are, like I said, whether you are from DPP, whether you're from MCP, whether you're from any party that you see fit, go for it and go for the bigger positions. Because Senegal has taught us that any position can be achieved by a youth.
35-year-old Mami Kugambewa is a young aspirant for a parliamentary seat in the upcoming 2025 elections. He says that financial constraints remain the greatest setback.
A bigger challenge that we face as young people is the lack of resources. You know, whenever people see a politician, they expect that they'll be given something, they'll be given some handouts. So because we don't have money, we don't have other resources, we fail to reach out to the electorate properly. So that's a very, very major challenge that we face as young politicians.
Malawi's Young Politicians Union is advocating for increased youth participation in politics. It has been lobbying for the reduction of the nomination fees for youth aspirants during the 2025 polls. Clement Magua is the executive director for the organization.
The lobby that they slashed down the nomination fee for ward councillors and the members of parliament that are going to be contesting 2025, so that they slash up to 50%. As it is now, they are at 75% nomination fee for everyone who is contesting below 35 years.
Political analyst Victor Jibovia has challenged young people to remain proactive in order to increase their representation in politics.
Most young people think that it is the responsibility and the duty of the older generation of politicians to give it to the young people. No, it doesn't work that way. It's the young people themselves that need to stand up to take up those positions.
Malawi's national youth policy advocates for 30% youth representation in governance structures. Minister of Youth Uchizi Mkandawire admits challenges in meeting this requirement.
So it has been more of gender issue than the youth. So we are shifting from that narrative now to start including the youth more, start talking about the youth more, other than just looking at the gender issue.
Remote areas will soon become campaign fields for aspirants gearing up for the 2025 general elections. These areas are, however, considered hard to reach by the young candidates who are mostly financially constrained. On the brighter side, young people have a number advantage. They are the country's majority, and with determination, some of them will eventually rise to the top. Chimwemwe Padata, VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
Women voters are more than half of the U.S. electorate. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports on what presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are doing to win women's votes.
Much of this presidential campaign's focus on women voters is centered on abortion laws and reproductive rights. But American women care about more than just abortion, and the campaigns are reaching out on broader issues, including the economy, health care, and crime. In Minnesota, voter Rebecca Jensen says President Joe Biden deserves credit for making what she says are the right decisions.
I think things about the environment are very important. I think the economy is important, and health care. I'm a nurse, and so I still see COVID at work frequently. And people keep saying, we're post-pandemic, but we're really not. We're still in the midst of it. So I just think that that having somebody that believes in science in the White House is a good thing.
In Nevada, voter Julie Bembe wants a second term for Donald Trump.
He was good for the economy. There was no war. There was harmony. There was peace. We were all working. The gas prices were normal. I mean, he was an amazing man. He loves his country. He's a good person. He raised a good family. And we're going to get him back.
Biden is targeting women voters with a White House initiative on women's health research.
Think of all the breakthroughs we've made in medicine across the board, but women have not been the focus. Research has been taking much too long to get to y'all.
When you say to a family that if you come, we're going to break you up, they don't come.
The Biden campaign released a Mother's Day social media ad attacking Trump's policy of separating immigrant families, telling voters to, quote, do the moms in your life a favor, stop Trump. Trump told a meeting of conservative Christian women that he'll bring peace to Europe.
Even over at the Oval Office, you can see I will have the horrible war between Russia and Ukraine settled.
Trump is also working to appeal to women voters with get tough messages on crime and immigration.
I think I do great with the suburban housewives because they want to remain safe. But they loot the jewelry, they take their purses, electronics, watches, all of their cash, and the people come back and they say, what happened? If you don't want illegal alien criminals crawling through your windows and ransacking your drawers, then you must vote for the fact that we have to throw crooked Joe Biden out as fast as possible, the damage he can do.
The Center for American Women in Politics says more women have voted than men in every U.S. presidential election since 1980. In their 2020 race, Pew Research data says Biden won the women's vote by 11 percentage points over Trump. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told lawmakers yesterday that a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas militants in return for the release of hostages remains possible, but he added that the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants for Israel's leaders hindered the effort. In a hearing of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, Blinken also said that Biden administration remains very concerned about Israel's planned major military operation in Rafah. Blinken said the extremely wrong-headed decision by the ICC prosecutor to seek arrest warrants for Israel's prime minister, defense minister, and three Hamas leaders for war crimes and crimes against humanity complicated the prospects of reaching such a deal. Some U.S. lawmakers are considering legislation to sanction ICC officials for persecuting U.S. citizens or allies, including Israel. Today, Norway, Ireland, and Spain said they will recognize a Palestinian state beginning May 28th, sparking delight from Palestinian leaders and fury from Israel. While the three nations hope other European countries will follow suit, France said it believes now is not the right moment to do so. Israel immediately announced it was recalling its envoys to Ireland and Norway for urgent consultations and was expected to do the same with its ambassador to Spain. The United States and most Western European nations have said they are willing to one day recognize Palestinian statehood, but not before agreement is reached on thorny issues like final borders and the status of Jerusalem. Chadian Prime Minister Success Masara handed in his resignation today, just over 2 weeks after his defeat to junta chief Mahamat Idriss Deby Itno in presidential elections. The move, Masara added, was in accordance with the constitution. Deby, 40, was proclaimed transitional president in April 2021 by a junta of 15 generals after his father, President Idriss Deby Itno, was shot dead by rebels after 30 years in power. The youngest Deby won the May 6th presidential vote with 61% of the ballot, according to final results. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Al Santos, Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.